MTC Planning Committee to order. Our first order of business is the Pledge of the Flag. I'd like to ask everyone to please stand and join me in the pledge.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic of which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, liberty, and justice for all.
Well, next month is our taxes are coming due on the 15th, and so those commissioners that are stressed out about that, I have some good news that you're going to receive $100 for this meeting today and up to $500 to help offset some of that. And so don't be so stressed out. And so we're doing everything we can to help. And this amount is provided as a result of convening a meeting for which each member is entitled to collect. So, Adrian, did that pretty much cover it? I mean, hopefully we've taken a little tension off and you're satisfied our legal obligation. So with that, let's move on into our meeting. We have on consent counter, we have the minutes from our February 14th meeting. Is there a motion to adopt?
So moved.
We have a motion and a second. There's no further discussion and no dissent. That motion passes unanimously. Do we have enough? Okay, we have a quorum. Okay, we don't have to deputize anybody. And okay, we designate the chair as a voting member. Okay, you're now designated and deputized. I don't think there's any formal swearing in we have to do, Amy. So I think you're good to go. Item number five, this is the Bay Area Commuter Benefits Program, and this is before us to move for Commission's approval. And Christine, are you going to present to kick this off?
Yes, thank you very much, members of the Planning Committee. My name is Christine Maley-Grubel. I'm the project manager for the Bay Area Commuter Benefits Program here at MTC. This program is in collaboration with the Bay Area Air Quality Management District, and I have two of the staff from the Air District here today, should you have any questions for them. Dave Birch, Senior Environmental Planner, here to my left. And we also have Wayne Kino, who's the Director of Compliance and Enforcement for the Air District, sitting behind Dave. In your packet is a copy of this PowerPoint presentation. And I'm just going to jump in. The program was based on Senate Bill 1339, which was enacted in the fall of 2012, authorizing MTC and the Air District to jointly adopt a regional commuter benefits program. It's modeled after local ordinances here in several Bay Area cities that you're probably familiar with, in San Francisco, in Berkeley, in Richmond, and also at the San Francisco Airport. The program must be approved by the MTC Commission and the Air District Board in order to take effect, and it is a pilot program that will sunset at the end of 2016 unless it is reauthorized. And a report is due to the state legislature on the impact of this program here in the Bay Area in July of 2016. So what is the purpose of the program? The purpose is to reduce motor vehicle trips to work sites, reducing traffic congestion and emissions of greenhouse gases, improving air quality. The other thing we want to ensure is that employers are aware of the tax advantages of federal commuter tax benefits for their employees, providing tax savings for both employers and employees. And also, this program can expand the number of employers that make commuter benefits available to their employees. So who does this apply to? This applies to employers with 50 or more full-time employees here in the Bay Area, all types of businesses, private, public, and nonprofit. And this is based on employer counts at all Bay Area work sites. So if an employer has 10 employees in one location and 45 in another, it would apply to all their work sites. And this is in the world of who does this apply to? There's about 10,000 employers here in the Bay Area that this would affect. So what are the options for an employer? There are four options that they can choose from. The first is a pre-tax payroll deduction for transit or van pool, which is currently at $130 per month as a maximum. The second is a direct subsidy for transit or van pool for employees. The third is an employer-provided transportation, such as a shuttle or a van, if an employer would like to provide that for their employees. And the fourth option has been set up for employers that perhaps might not be near fixed transit and might not have it in their area, providing them with some pre-approved options through a working group that the Air District established, including a carpool-type package, a bicycle package, as well as the option for an employer to also indicate an option that they would like to try at their work site, and they can submit that for review. So they would have that option as well if the other options don't work for them. So what are the program requirements? The employer is asked to select one of these four options, designate what we're calling a commuter benefits coordinator, which is not a new position for an employer. This is someone on staff that could complete the registration form for them. They'd register on 511.org, notify employees, and make the benefit available. And if asked by the Air District or MTC, provide some information to help us with the program evaluation. So what are the program elements? The Air District has drafted a new rule, Regulation 14, Rule 1, to serve as the foundation for the program. They put together the guidelines that include the options and the requirements for the program. MTC will be providing employer assistance through the 511 Regional Rideshare Program through their Employer Outreach Program. And there has been a web-based registration system that's been established and an employer database to keep track of the employers that have complied with the program. The objective, to make this as easy as possible for employers and to minimize administrative requirements. So what are the roles and responsibilities of the Air District and MTC? The Air District, as mentioned, developed the rule and the guidelines to complement the rule. We'll also be overseeing compliance, verification, and enforcement for the program. And MTC's role being to provide employer assistance through the regional rideshare program and to develop the employer assistance materials and the registration process. There was quite a bit of public outreach that was done in order to put this rule together, engaging a wide range of stakeholders from employers to congestion management agencies to transportation management associations and also the transit agencies. The draft rule and workshop report was issued in late August, and there were public workshops held in each of the nine Bay Area counties in October to provide input on the draft program. From there, the input was included in the revised program elements that were put together. What kind of input did we receive? Quite a bit was about keeping this as easy as possible for employers, keeping it simple. A desire for assistance to understand the different options and the potential tax benefits for employers and employees, and an interest in option four for those employers that are not well served by transit. We also received some feedback that some employers are not necessarily supportive of a mandatory approach. So as we prepare for implementation, we're providing employer assistance through the 511.org website. We have a website landing page, an employer guide and other materials. There will be a phone helpline by calling 511, say commuter benefits, and you'll be directed to the regional rideshare program staff. The registration system's being developed. And then also we've gone through over the past several months coordinating with stakeholders, including the local cities that have commuter benefit ordinances, TMAs, CMAs, and also local employer outreach programs in delegated counties that are not, actually doing the employer outreach on behalf of the county. This is an example of the website landing page, the idea being to take employers from the homepage of 511.org. They would click on a button for this program, and they would be directed to this page. This will provide them with all the information and employer outreach and assistance materials, as well as information on contacts if they need help from employer outreach staff. There's that large button on the right-hand upper side saying click here to register, which is where employers will go to register for the program. So the process and timeline. The notice of public hearing was issued by the Air District in late January with the 30-day public comment period following. Included with the notice was the proposed rule, a staff report, a socioeconomic analysis, and a CEQA document. Today we're here for the Planning Committee to receive this information and answer questions. From here, if approved, this would go on to the Air District Board on March 19th and then on to MTC's Commission on March 26th. The program would be implemented soon after. With that all in place, employers would have until September 30th to register and comply with this program. This is the last slide of these slides. Air District and MTC views this as positive outcomes for employers and employees. There's tax savings, payroll tax savings for employers. Employees can save 40% or more on their after-tax commuter costs on transit and vanpool fares, in addition to helping enhance the employees' benefit package. I wanted to add, too, that my contact information is here, and I've been asked to also report on the outcome of this program overview to the Policy Advisory Council at their meeting on March 11th. Comments on the program were positive. There were just clarifying questions about the program options, tax savings, and community outreach that had been conducted. In addition, there were comments on another subject separate from this program presentation that were asked to be provided as part of this report for the Planning Committee's information. The comments were that there was a concern expressed that air quality standards set by the Air District conflict with the ability of local jurisdictions to efficiently advance infill development in PDAs. There were some comments about that. So the Council indicated that they would like to look into this into the future. They wanted the Planning Committee to be aware of that. So in conclusion, staff is recommending that the committee forward Resolution 4134 to the full commission for approval to support implementation of this program pursuant to Senate Bill 1339, pending approval by the Air District Board on March 19th. And the Air District staff that is here and I are both would be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay. Can you expand a little bit on how you're going to measure progress or success? I mean,
yes. So during the registration process, we will be collecting information from the employers on the option that they are going to be providing to their employees, confirming how many employees they have, we will do one more annual registration to ask them how many employees are now utilizing the program so we can measure the number of employees that are doing that as well. And we're confirming program evaluation and may be doing a phone survey possibly, the idea being to collect how many employees have actually shifted their commute mode as a part of the measurements that have been asked as a part of the Senate bill for the report.
Okay, so you have an inventory of all these businesses, and then you're going to check in with them and see who's complied, who hasn't, and then you're going to offer assistance for the ones that are struggling. I'm assuming that the more rural areas are going to have the biggest challenge. I mean, how do you see that?
Yes, and I think what's going to be really helpful is having this option number 4. And I'm going to ask Dave if you'd like.
Yeah, if you could expand. That was my next question. I was going to ask you to expand on.
Sure.
On option 4, and then I wanted to hear from the Air District representative, give a little background on what they adopted.
So, as Christine mentioned, there is in Senate Bill 1339 a provision that says that there's these three basic options that are well-defined, and then there's a fourth option, which is basically for an employer to submit an alternative commuter benefit proposal. And that can be anything that the employer might choose to propose. However, in dialogue with the employers and other stakeholders on this process, there's been a desire expressed by employers to, you know, give us some clarity about, you know, what kind of things would you be looking for under that option 4. So we put together a working group. We included representatives from employer assistance programs around the area, including the Solano Napa program. And those folks gave us input in putting together some ideas for what types of things an employer could propose there that would be more or less pre-approved on our end. So, as Christine mentioned, we saw this as an opportunity to promote alternative modes that are not so much addressed directly by options 1, 2, or 3. And these are the modes that would probably be most appropriate out in some of the areas that are not well served by transit. So we're talking about things like carpooling, bicycling, teleworking, compressed work weeks. So we will be putting together, as part of the guidelines we issue for this, specific guidance about things that an employer could do under this option four, because it's our goal to come up with something that will make sense for employers out in areas that are not well served by transit. So we've gone through a lot of dialogue in order to put those guidelines together for option four.
Okay, so I'm assuming we're going to have businesses that are going to offer these options. Now, how are you going to monitor whether the employees are taking advantage of it? We actually see a mode shift. I mean, are those two different issues, or how do you see that?
Well, one of the things we will be doing during the registration process is asking the employer to indicate to us how they're going to promote the new program or the new option to their employees. They're indicating when they're submitting the form that this is what we're doing. As far as the mode shift, as we're talking about determining the best way to do the program evaluation, we do want to actually ask employees, what did you do before this regulation was put into place? What are you doing now as far as commuting to and from work? So I think that's going to help us measure the mode shift.
Okay. And I don't know if we can hear from the Air District on that rule four, regulation 14 rule one, just a real quick background on that. Is there somebody?
So we, the Senate bill 1339 provided the template for this program, and it defined things pretty well, but there were some areas where we needed to define terms or flesh out the direction that we got in the Senate bill. So we have come up with a proposed new regulation, Regulation 14 Rule 1, that would serve as the foundation for this program. And it basically just defines the key terms and those key requirements that Christine
summarized. So it's a framework of okay.
That's correct.
Yeah. Well, I was familiar with it. Had some familiarity. Other questions? Oh, I'm sorry. Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy this discussion about transit not being accessible to certain areas. I think, and I'd like to talk a little bit more about this. I think one thing that we haven't thought about is lower income people that are riding transit late at night. For example, they get off work at 1 in the morning and there's no transit there. And they're not really that wild about maybe walking through a desolate area, and they can't telecommute because maybe they're in a service industry mm-hmm. of some sort, whether it be fast food or maybe they're working at a store that's open late at night. I can think of an area in my district that is a lot of homes around it, and there's a restaurant there. It closes at 1. And there's no way for these people to go. And obviously, they're not going to be able to telecommute. They can't really walk. They could ride a bike if they ride fast. So I don't know how we get at those people, I guess, is what I'm saying. And even in the answer I just heard, I think we've always assumed that people have other ways that they could maybe work, telecommute, things like that. Well, if they're in other industries, service industries, that's not the case. And I don't know how we capture those people, and I don't know how we expect the employers to capture those people, because it's worthless for them to buy a bus pass or something for the month when the buses don't run past 9 o'clock in that area.
I completely agree that it's very difficult, and I think one of the things that makes this program a little more flexible is through this option four. Our employer outreach staff through the regional rideshare program or the delegated counties can work directly with an employer to come up with a different solution. If they don't fall under these other either the pre-approved options or this options 1 through 3, I don't have an answer for what we would do, but I can say we can work with them and try to come up with something. And that is a part of the flexibility of this particular rule.
Yeah, but I don't think there's an option. That's what I'm saying. Unless this person, and we have to, I mean, I'm assuming that they do not have a car. Maybe they can't afford it. Maybe they can't afford the insurance. But take the car out of it. We don't want them in the car anyways. There's no transit. They can't telecommute. I don't know what you can tell the employer that's going to work. And so what does the employer do? Because probably half of their employee base is working late at night. And so I don't know what we do. I really don't know what we tell. And I'm in this position because I don't know what to tell the employer. Buy them bikes, buy them cars, run a shuttle van.
Commissioner, maybe I could just try two answers. You know, the first in terms of your example, which is a hard case, I think. You know, carpooling might be an option. If there's more than one person who's working till 1 in the morning, there might be a conceivable way for them to share a ride. But I think the more important point is that what the law requires is that employers offer something. It doesn't require that employees accept it. It doesn't require that a certain number of employees accept it and switch modes. So I think it is the case, and it's, I think, a perfectly acceptable result that we don't see a 100% change in behavior here. What we're looking at, and we'll have some more conversation about this at your workshop at the end of the month, what we're looking at in many cases are fairly small swings, especially during the peak hours, can have very significant benefits for the operation, especially of the freeway system. So I think there are going to be cases like you cite, probably many others, where we may not be able to change behavior, and I think that's okay. This is a pilot. We want to learn what works, what doesn't, and then go from there.
Sam and then Amy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question about enforcement. Who enforces how? What's the penalty? I guess that's three questions. Sorry.
Okay. So I'm Wayne Keno. I'm the Director of Compliance and Enforcement. So in any enforcement program that the Air District undertakes, we have an element of compliance. That's why our division is compliance and enforcement. So we try to get these facilities to comply with the letter of the law. We'll do outreach. 511.org and MTC is doing a lot of outreach. We'll do additional outreach also. If they don't comply, we try and give them every opportunity to comply. If they don't, we can apply various levels of enforcement. And in this case, we'll probably give them what we would call a notice to comply, which is a fix-it ticket. It's an informal notice that you're not in compliance, and it gives you a certain time period to come into compliance. It can be 30 days, 60 days. That usually gets people to come in and into compliance at that point. If it gets to the point where somebody actually refuses to comply, we can step up our enforcement program, issue a violation notice, which has some penalties. We don't normally would get to that point with this kind of program, but if we do, and there's a certain amount of people that may, there is a penalty, and it's a per-day violation. So we've done everything we can to try to get these people in compliance. They're refusing to do that. It could range from several hundred dollars to several thousand dollars, depending on the circumstances. If, for instance, a company, you know, we send a lot of outreach material to them, and it's not getting to the right person, our investigation will show that, and the penalties will be less. So it depends on the circumstances of each violation.
Okay, that seems reasonable. Question, though, about, I guess maybe this is, in fact, I'm a recovering criminal prosecutor. I always want to think about what you do when folks are cheating. So if someone has been retroactively not carrying their share of the load, I understand a compliance-first approach, which makes a lot of sense from a regulatory standpoint, but can you assess fines for retroactive failure to comply?
Yes.
Okay.
We can.
And you're inclined to do so?
Yeah, well, this program, the effective date will be September, I believe, of 2014.
Excuse me, would be when the two boards, assuming they adopted it, would go into effect at that time. But we will give employers 6 months to come into compliance. That would be by the end of September.
Okay, so if they've been So every cutting corners, they would be compliance would mean they have to pay up.
Yes.
In order to come into compliance for
there's some monetary penalty if we issue a violation notice. If we can get them to comply and give them all the methods to comply, and maybe they didn't quite understand option four or they didn't know that was available, that goes into the consideration for the penalty.
Great, thanks.
Can I get a clarification on compliance? Because, I mean, Steve said something. Is compliance offering the program or compliance people using it?
My understanding in looking at the rule, it's actually offering the program, making it available, and making sure your employees know about it.
Okay. See, that's a lot more reasonable. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. That clarification.
Can I just jump on
that? Yeah, go ahead. Amy's so, next, but go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is it just the employer mailing or, say, when the paychecks go out, a letter offering that they're going to, you know, they can do pre-tax transit pass buying? Is that compliant?
Yes, that would be compliant. If the employer selects option one and informs their employees through some reasonable method of communication and registers with us to tell us that that's what they're doing to comply, then they would be compliant, yes.
Okay, so I have Amy, and then Steve, and then Tom.
Great. Thank you very much for that presentation. And I kind of wanted to follow up on some of Commissioner Haggerty's earlier questions about, you know, the whole issue about employers who aren't near, who either have work hours that are off of commute hours or are in areas where the availability of transit isn't as robust. And I guess that was my question about option four. Clearly, the intention is to be able to offer employees a way of reducing car trips, whether it's carpooling or vanpool. So I'm wondering when we have the option four in this program. So can you talk a little bit more about the technical assistance relative to helping employers that might want to develop option four? I know, for example, a number of our employers in Contra Costa County, particularly the business parks, offer a variety of incentives. They subsidize some of the public transit resources that are coming into those sites. I mean, are there ways that companies can aggregate within, say, within an employer group, say, a business park, to offer these kinds of benefits? And what kinds of things are we going to do to promote? Because I think carpooling, I saw the letter from Karma, for example, that this kind of cohort carpooling may be a really good viable option for employees to actually make that mode shift in terms of reducing car trips. So is there the financial benefit and assessment for that incentive for that too? And will we be offering more technical assistance on the option four?
We definitely will be offering the technical assistance, and I think what's a really nice opportunity for the regional rideshare program and their employer outreach staff is to be available to offer in-person, on the phone, and online assistance. We really spent a lot of time setting up and completing the employer outreach materials, too, directing people online as well to find as much information as they need that way. In terms of incentives, I think there's a real opportunity with throughout the year, through the regional rideshare program, they offer a number of incentive programs and promotions for different types of things like carpool subsidies and incentives and things like that. So I think that opportunity to really promote those programs to business parks and to employers so that they can take advantage of them. Also working with the local delegated counties, so in San Mateo County, the commute.org, the Alliance, Contra Costa has their program as well. So working closely with them, which the regional program does on an ongoing basis, but I think this is just another opportunity to work more in partnership.
Steve?
Thank you. Just an initial question. Is this program one that was mandated, or was the opportunity provided to the regional agencies?
SB 1339 authorizes the agencies, the Air District and MTC, to work together to develop a program. It does not mandate that we do. That's a discretionary action on the part of the Commission and the Air District Board.
I think we should start these presentations by why we want to do it, so we understand why we're doing it, because there are a lot of people that aren't former prosecutors who actually are concerned about regulation. And I think we just need to explain it maybe in the context of how we're trying to hit our targets. Is this the behavior change piece of our total plan? So that's a question that I have. I also, you know, the issue, I agreed with our chair about measuring the outcomes, and you talked about user surveys to get there. There's nothing in those regs that I saw that require the employer to do a certain level of monitoring. You say you ask them for the reports, but, you know, compliance might be notification of the opportunity, but, you know, that's going to be important. And when we compare this kind of investment against other things, it would be helpful from my perspective to see, are we changing VMT? Are we doing anything above and beyond a more general goal to move people towards transit or shared rides and so forth? And then, you know, on the last slide that you showed some benefits to the employer. Do you anticipate that employers will perceive that this is a cost-neutral responsibility that they're taking on, or even a cost-beneficial one, based on that slide?
That, I'm sorry, to that last question. Depending on if employees are utilizing, say, for instance, option one, the pre-tax benefit, the $130 per month, the employer is going to be saving on FICA taxes on the amounts that the employee is invested in the $130. And how it comes out, basically, we see approximately $120 per year per employee if that employee is taking advantage of the $130. That is to the employer. If an employer is using a third-party vendor to set up that pre-tax benefit, we are seeing an average of $3 to $5 per employee. So to answer your question, the employer would either come out even or actually ahead if they offer the pre-tax benefit and their employees take advantage of it.
On the other options, you know, in terms of running the transit or providing the service?
With the other options, it's a little less straightforward because the employer has more discretion about what they would do, especially, let's say, option three. So that's one where the employer would provide transportation. That could be a bus service from the home community to the work site. It could be a shuttle from a nearby transit station. You know, to be honest, those are pretty expensive propositions. And our expectation is that not very many employers would start a new program like that simply to comply with this regulation, which is pretty modest in its scope. Employers that would offer option three are probably employers with deep pockets that are already doing this kind of thing for their own business reasons. So our expectation is that most employers will select the most cost-effective option, which would, in most cases, would be option one, and would either come out a little bit ahead or pretty much you know, break even on this. Some employers that had other reasons to provide one of the other options, such as option three, might in fact incur higher costs, but they would probably have other business reasons for making that decision.
Thank you.
Okay, Tom?
So thank you very much. Some of my questions have been answered, but I'm wondering, I got here a little late and I apologize. So can an employer offer more than one plan?
Yes, certainly. We are encouraging that, actually, if they would like to do so.
Okay. And the other point is, I'm wondering if two parties decide to carpool, how does that benefit given to those two employees? In other words, I'm not going to drive anymore, and I'm going to go with Sam, who's got a car, and we're going to carpool. So how is it benefits? How do I benefit? How does that get figured?
So how does that benefit the employees?
Yeah, I mean...
Oh, yes, of course. So they're saving on the cost of
I mean, to the tax benefit. How does the tax benefit get distributed?
The tax benefit, unfortunately, the federal tax benefit doesn't cover carpools. So what we have done for purposes of this program is part of option four. Certainly, if an employer wants to establish some sort of carpool program, that's one of the, what we're calling a pre-approved option that the employer could establish for its employees, but there is no tax benefit.
So that if I were to try to put promote people to carpool, there's no way that they can get a pre-tax benefit, even under option four. Is that right? I just wanted to get a clarification.
That's right. There's no pre-tax benefit the way that the legislation is currently written.
Commissioner, there could be other ways for the employer to give them a benefit. I mean, a number of large employers who have big parking lots will give preferred spaces to carpoolers. One of the most effective ways to deal with this, although it's also a bit of a challenge to some companies, is if they're able to cash out their parking. And basically what happens in that situation, for example, is you start charging for parking where it used to be free, and for carpools and anyone else you want to designate, the charge equals an amount you give them. So they don't feel any different. And the person who is driving alone is facing a charge for the first time and therefore is encouraged to maybe carpool or take transit or some other option. So there are at least a couple of different strategies. Cash out is difficult just because parking is bundled very often into what a business buys when it buys space. But preferential parking and other kinds of strategies, you know, employers have been very creative. And I think one thing that might help your discussion, and I'll ask Christine or Dave if they know the answer to this, you know, this program will affect 10,000 employers. Do we have a sense of how many of them are already complying in the sense that they've already done this stuff?
We don't have any direct data for Bay Area specifically. There are existing local ordinances in several cities, including San Francisco, as was already mentioned. In the case of San Francisco, they found that roughly half of the employers were already offering something before the program went into effect. It will probably be a little bit of a lower percentage when you get into the region as a whole, and it'll probably vary in part on depending on what their proximity to transit is and what the employer size is. But probably about a third of the employers are already going to be compliant just by virtue of what they're already doing.
Okay.
So I do think that one of our key challenges is to sort of share the knowledge, right? I mean, you've got several thousand employers who have been doing this in many cases for decades. And I think the challenge really is to the newer employers, especially the smaller ones who are sort of right near that cutoff of 50, and to share knowledge that has been learned by the larger employers who've been doing it for a longer time.
So just in conclusion, Commissioner Haggerty's question about the end, one of the possibilities was carpool. Well, it's not really an option. I mean, in the sense that there's no tax break. So I'm wondering if anybody has tried to figure out how we can get that kind of incentive where we can get people to carpool and provide some kind. I realize what Executive Director Heminger said, that you can do it maybe on the one end and not charge parking. But we have an instance in Berkeley where we have the Unified School District that has about 350 parking spaces, free parking spaces for the teachers and staff. There's absolutely no incentive whatsoever for them to reduce. I mean, we're not charging for parking. And not about to, and they, you know, they, and transportation, since they have odd hours, they have to be there, you know, at different times. They want to leave at different times, so it's difficult to take transit. So, I really think my personal pitch is to try to get more people in cars, and I think there's got to be some kind of fiscal incentive. So, maybe we can think through the legislative committee or some other people how we can establish that as a benefit in some way.
Yeah. Sam, did you have a final comment? Turn your mic on here.
Mr. Kinsey raised a larger question about what their goal is. And it just be helpful, I think, for us to rewind the tape maybe 3 years when we were trying to figure out how we actually have an impact on greenhouse gas emissions with this entire plan. And I can remember, you know, seeing very small changes in GHG emissions when we were looking at Plan Bay Area around a lot of what we hoped would move the needle around land use changes and all the things we know we need to do, investments in transit. It seemed as though price mechanisms and how they affect driving and commuting behavior did have a significant change. And Maybe, Steve, could you just remind us about that?
Commissioner, you're absolutely right. I mean, the traditional approach to any transportation problem is on the supply side, right? The old solution was let's build more highways. The more recent solution is let's build more transit systems. But the demand side is where you can really make some gains. And price on the demand side is where you can make the most gains of those. But there are still other demand side strategies, and we think working with the business community is one of them. They employ the workers who are using the roads. The notion of flexible hours would be one of the most dramatic things we could do if we could talk enough employers into doing it, because the peaking phenomenon you see out there every day is as a result of those employees having to be at work at a certain time.
Right.
If that could vary, we've seen evidence in Los Angeles, you know, where they have got a lot of compressed work time. And so every other Friday, and in fact every Friday, because for a lot of people every other Friday is every Friday, you see lower traffic levels. So demand strategies, I think, are the place where we need to spend a lot more of our attention in trying to make progress.
I agree, and I also think that an element of this is really, in fact, a pricing strategy in some way. It does affect the pocketbook of the commuter and the employer, and that does change behavior.
Well, and Commissioner Bates is correct. If we could talk the Congress into having a tax incentive strategy that's not just transit. I mean, for many years, we've been focused on trying to make the transit benefit equal to the parking at work for free benefit. And that's been a struggle. But, you know, you hear from the bikers and from advocates for carpooling, why can't they qualify? And there's no good answer to why they shouldn't.
Okay, it's a very good discussion. And so I don't see any other lights. And so Christine, Wayne, and Dave, thank you. And we'll move on to the next item. Thank you. Oh, do we have to take action on this?
Yes.
Okay, I'll entertain a motion. I'm sorry, I'll entertain a motion to approve Resolution 4134 for commission approval. We have a motion and a second. If there's no further discussion, any dissent? Hearing none, that motion passes unanimously. Thank you.
Thank you.
You got success there. And we'll go to the goods movement and this planning update. And Carolyn, you're up for the second time.
Good morning, Commissioners. Carolyn Clevenger with MTC Planning. This is an informational item. Today I'm going to give you an update on some exciting goods movement planning efforts underway within the region. In the region, Alameda CTC recently kicked off their first countywide goods movement plan. And in close collaboration and coordination with that effort, MTC is going to be updating our regional goods movement plan. With me today, I have Michael Fisher, who's our consultant on the efforts from Cambridge Systematics. Some of you who were here in 2004 might remember him from our regional goods movement plan that was completed in 2004. He's also done similar efforts in Southern California, as well as the Central Valley and Central Coast, so we're in good hands. And also with me is Tess Lingell, who is the deputy director for Alameda CTC, and she's been leading their countywide efforts and also established the collaborative that I'll be describing later on in the outline today. At the end, I'll give you a very brief update on some of the ongoing state and federal activities. The planning work underway in the region includes two closely integrated plans that will result in two distinct plans at the end of the year-and-a-half effort, a regional goods movement plan that will focus on needs and strategies at a regional level, looking at primarily the corridors in the region that serve our freight network. And we'll be recommending institutional, infrastructure, operational, and policy strategies to help improve goods movement efficiencies and reduce impacts on communities in the region. This work we are completing in time to be able to inform the next long-range plan scheduled for adoption in 2017. At the county level, Alameda County will be taking a deeper dive into many of the county freight issues. They'll be looking at some of their arterial systems as well as some movement in the urban core, looking at delivery issues, truck route issues, things like that that get on a more localized level. And that will, for them, serve as input into the next countywide plan. The work will also result in coordinated advocacy material for both the region and county. We're also working with our partners in our neighboring regions, which I'll get into briefly, on coordinated Northern California mega region advocacy material. And as I mentioned, we are establishing this collaborative to support the ongoing planning work and help advance the recommendations that come out of the work. So the idea is, since we have these two planning efforts, really bring stakeholders in one coordinated effort so that they're not being pulled in multiple directions, and we can really create some energy within the region to support our goods movement recommendations and to keep that group alive after the planning effort is done to help with implementation and ongoing advocacy at the state and national level. The project is in four phases. The outreach work, which is currently underway, we have been establishing this round, this goods movement leadership team, and we are working to set up a kickoff roundtable towards the end of May, and meeting with a number of stakeholders doing focus group interviews to get input before we really dive deep into the planning work. The next phase, which will be this spring and summer, is going to be doing the baseline and needs assessment. Caltrans District 4 has recently completed a Bay Area freight study, which really provides a lot of detailed data and some robust information for both planning efforts, so we're going to use that as much as possible so that we're not duplicating efforts. And then in the fall, we'll be starting to develop the strategies, looking at infrastructure packages, operational, institutional, and policy recommendations for the goods movement system, both within the region and the county. And as I mentioned, we will have two final plans in 2015. The regional goods movement plan will obviously come to this committee, and then Alameda's plan will go to their own committee for adoption. The project does include a very robust collaborative outreach effort. We have a leadership team, which is really a management team of agency executives whose agencies are very actively involved in goods movement within the region. This group meets periodically throughout the course of the project to be able to provide strategy and guidance to staff as we advance the planning and advocacy work. And they also help advocate and bring their agencies in to support planning efforts within each of the agencies that are part of that leadership team. On the technical side, we are having both a regional technical advisory committee, as well as Alameda County is using their standing technical advisory committee to advise on their effort. And the technical committees will really be able to provide technical feedback on deliverables, as well as bring local perspective into the planning efforts. At the regional level, it'll be sort of that county level of input, and then at Alameda, they'll be working with all of their cities to get city-level input. As I mentioned, we're underway right now with a number of focus group meetings with stakeholders. We will continue to meet with stakeholders from the business community, economic development community, as well as local communities who are impacted by goods movement, public health advocates, environmental groups, and businesses involved in goods movement and organizations that they belong to. We'll be meeting with them throughout the course of the project whenever we are starting to have big deliverables or big decision points. We will be bringing them together in these focus group settings to have a dialogue with them, get their input, and be able to inform the recommendations that staff brings to you. And we are setting up these roundtables. We're scheduled to do about six throughout the course of the year and a half planning effort, and hopefully continue some of those after the planning effort, that will bring together all these different focus groups. We're going to have a kickoff at the end of May, and then we'll look to have some more subject matter roundtables through the course of the project. And that's really the forum for bringing all of these different stakeholders together to talk about goods movement in the region and in Alameda County. Just to give you a little flavor of some of the work that's been underway, the Bay Area Goods Movement System is composed of five major sort of functional elements. We have the global gateways, which is often, for many people, one of the more visible aspects of freight within the region. This includes the region's international trade infrastructure, namely the seaports and airports. And international trade is growing at a faster rate than domestic trade, with exports forecast to be particularly robust over the coming 5 to 20 years. So we do expect to see continued growth at these facilities. We also have the interregional corridors. Those are the networks that are supporting both imports and exports, as well as a lot of our domestic freight movements. That includes both highway and rails that connect the area to other parts of the nation and state.
Mm-hmm. Carolyn, okay, go ahead.
Okay. The primary corridors are the Altamont Corridor, which is the 880 to 38580 corridor. This is where we have by far the highest truck volumes within the region, connecting the Bay Area to the Central Valley. There's also rail corridor along that same corridor, although it's less used than the rail piece heading north out of the Bay Area. The other major corridor is the Central Corridor, which is essentially the I-80 corridor and the Capital and freight rail that runs parallel to that corridor up to Sacramento and out across the country. In addition, there are two smaller interregional corridors, Highway 12 in the North Bay and a State Route 152 in the South Bay, that provide critical east-west linkages and help support agriculture, in particular, moving into the Bay Area for export. On the intra-regional side, these are corridors serving the Central Bay Area and providing primary access to the major goods movement facilities in the region. The major intra-regional corridors include, and this map just shows a subset of them in part for readability, but the 101 corridor, 680 and 880 are the primary intra-regional corridors. Corridors such as 80, 580, and 880, they're also intra-regional, do help serve intra-regional purposes as well. So there is overlap amongst these corridors. And on the intra-regional side, it's exclusively truck-dependent given the short distances that most of these goods are traveling. The other two major functional...
Carolyn, yeah? 1 second.
I'm sorry, Carolyn. I'm a little confused on this slide, and I'm not trying to be greedy because I know that you've acknowledged 580 and 205 in the previous slide. I guess I'm not understanding why on this slide they're not included also. And at the very minimum, if you're saying, well, there's not a lot of inter-regional traffic on 580, which I kind of doubt, but I'll accept that. It seems to me like 238 should be acknowledged if you're going to say that there's a lot of traffic traveling between the 880 corridor and 680.
Yeah, they definitely do carry a lot of intra-regional travel as well. This was mainly to try and highlight some of the other corridors, but by far 580 has the highest truck volumes in the region.
I heard that in the last slide, and like I said, I'm not trying to be greedy. I guess I'm just... I think I would make a plea on this slide here that 238 should be acknowledged between 880 and 680.
Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense.
Okay, thank you.
All right, go
ahead. And the final two functional elements are the urban goods movement system. This is a lot of the trucks that people see on their day-to-day delivering goods, picking up packages and parcels through their neighborhoods, and providing some of the... sort of last-mile connections within city streets to destinations serving our consumers within this region. And the last-mile connectors focuses on a lot of the last-mile connections to the major freight facilities such as ports, industrial areas, warehousing centers, and such. We have started to look at what sets our region apart in the Bay Area, particularly as we look at state and national efforts related to freight. And this came up some when we were developing our federal freight policies here, that the Bay Area is an export economy in terms of our international goods movement, and it is something that really does set our region apart. So we will continue to work on how we can support the agriculture and food products, moving both from within our region and out to export destinations, as well as goods moving from the Central Valley and Central Coast through our region. We are, as you know, a large mega regional context with the Central Valley and Sacramento connections here. We do have farm-to-market issues that are somewhat unique to have both the urban issues as well as farm-to-market, so that is something that we think sets our region apart a little bit. And in terms of the planning within a modern urban center, we are looking at how we can integrate freight better into some of our ongoing complete streets work and PDA planning work, as well as comprehensive arterial corridor planning. Alameda is going to be taking a lead at doing some arterial corridor planning work within their county, which we hope to learn from and be able to apply across the region, and looking at how intelligent transportation systems can help improve the movement of goods both within and through our region. And the next two slides just elaborate briefly on the mega region aspects of goods movement. We are a very integrated economy with the surrounding regions in Sacramento, Central Valley, and Central Coast areas. In terms of the Bay Area, we are the international trade hub. We're also a major producer of fuels, particularly along the northern Contra Costa and lower Solano County waterfronts. We do still produce some high-value manufactured products, and we are a very large consumer center. So a lot of the freight we see moving is for our local demand to serve our population. And our surrounding regions all have very strong agricultural aspects. And then the Central Valley, the San Joaquin Valley, has really become a major warehousing and distribution center serving both our region and the rest of the country. In terms of work in progress, as I mentioned, we are partway through our stakeholder interviews, and we are starting to develop baseline and needs assessment work, putting together some advocacy material, and planning for this roundtable kickoff, a joint Alameda County and MTC roundtable event at the end of May. I'll touch just very briefly on some of the state activity underway. Caltrans is still working on their freight mobility plan, their statewide effort that's coming out of the MAP 21 requirements for states to do the statewide freight planning. And they do anticipate finishing that up by the end of this year. California Air Resources Board has also just recently kicked off a sustainable freight strategy effort where they'll be doing a lot of research on zero and near zero emissions technologies. So we do hope to learn from that to see what types of technologies and approaches might be applied in the region. And they are looking to release that in the draft, at least, of that work in the fall, finalizing it by the end of the year. So with that, as I said, this is an informational item. We'll be happy to take any questions.
Sam, we'll start off with Sam.
I wanted to follow up on the question of my distinguished colleague from the great state of Alameda about particular corridors. As I looked at those maps, I didn't see any reference to 238, I'm sorry, to 128, excuse me, to 5. And I'm curious if we have any quantitative measure. I think anybody would concede that the ports in Oakland and Alameda County carry far in excess of whatever cargo comes in through Highway 5 from L.A. or from the Central Valley. But the fact that they're not on the map and the fact that there really isn't any discussion there has me at least concerned. And the first question is, do we have some clear quantitative measures to understand what the relative quantity is, to understand if we're perhaps ignoring important corridors that should be attended to?
In terms of the corridor definitions, what we've been trying to do is at least start from some of the threshold definitions that were adopted by the California Freight Advisory Committee based on truck volumes on corridors. And so that sort of defined what we are calling major truck routes. We are trying to acknowledge that other corridors do have specific functions in the system, and we're trying to continue to learn a little bit more about what is the nature of the types of goods that move on some of those corridors. So one of the things that we're going to be doing over the next several months is we've compiled some information about commodity movements at the regional level, and we're trying to get down to a more refined geography so we can start looking at what are commodity values and tonnages moving on specific roadways. So I think those maps that you see are definitely being refined, and I wouldn't consider that a final product. At this time, we're still developing that information.
Okay. Allow me to make a parochial pitch then, perhaps, for a revision that would be more expansive. And I guess it would also be very helpful to really make those numbers very explicit so we understand.
Sure.
I'm sure at the end of the day we'll concede that goods movement overwhelmingly is focused in Alameda County, but at least understanding where what the numbers are would be helpful, because you know I'm certain that the Highway 5 connection is a critical one, not just for the largest city in the region, San Jose, but in fact all the cities up the peninsula to San Francisco. And I'm concerned if we've got maps that don't even include it.
Good point.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Carolyn, is there any discussion about economic development or how this plan is integrated into the local jurisdictions and the types of things that they can do? You know, and an example I would use up in Solano County, where we have Interstate 80 and we have a major freight corridor that intersect, and there seems to be such opportunities if you could move goods from rail out to maybe an outer county and then move from there. Is the study going to be looking at those types of opportunities?
Yeah, we'll definitely be looking at the economic development aspect, both in terms of supporting businesses within our region, supporting jobs in our region. We do have some numbers on a regional level about jobs related to goods movement, and we will be looking for strategies for how you can improve and increase those jobs. Within our advisory, within the stakeholder groups that we've been meeting with, we have been reaching out to local economic development agencies, chambers of commerce, and starting meeting with them to hear, what initiatives they have underway also to better understand what they're doing and how we can kind of leverage that and make recommendations that hopefully they can also help us implement.
Yeah, I think it would be good to incorporate that into presentations to where we make that local connection a little clearer. So, okay, any other? This is an information item, so. Oh, I'm sorry.
Port of Oakland.
Mayor Kwan.
Would you just step back for me a little bit? So what happens with this regional plan is do we do fund allocations based on need because everyone's advocating now for their freeway or highway? Will you give me the bigger picture of what you do with this plan and what we'll do with it?
Commissioner, I think the bigger picture is, as you know, we spent a whole lot of time in our last long-range plan, Plan Bay Area, talking about greenhouse gas emissions and public transit and, generally speaking, moving people. I think, frankly, we didn't spend enough time talking about moving goods.
Okay.
And that is a very large part of the equation. And as the chairman just indicated, very often you've got corridors that are trying to do both at once, and that's difficult. So my hope is that once we get this work behind us, it will position us to address the issue much better in our next long-range plan. I think it will eventually lead to a platform and project ideas that we might be able to hawk in Washington or Sacramento. We just had some commissioners go back to Washington earlier this week, and we are talking about in the next federal authorizing bill having a particular freight program with dedicated funding.
Okay.
And that funding will either be formula or discretionary, and either way, we will want to be competing for funds for projects in our region, and not just on the road system, but on rail. So I think we're hoping to use this to deepen our understanding about what's going on out there, and then to translate that into projects and action.
Okay, so my comments will be on point then. A couple of points. The Oakland Estuary is booming right now. So we yesterday broke ground on 3,000 residential homes, and a few months ago we broke ground on probably the largest intermodal port project underway right now in the United States. So when I looked at the projects, and I don't have any on the East Bay big projects, I actually think the intermodal freight operations both at the Oakland Airport and at the Port of Oakland should have a regional emphasis and not just a local one, because we provide 75,000 jobs daily for the region in import-exports. And with the growing, literally growing appetite of the Chinese population and in Asia, our food exports made us the first port to export more than we imported during the Obama initiative to increase exports. And I can tell you that with the with the Army-based project, that the new logistics facilities are going to increasingly be bringing in goods on an intermodal basis, increasingly by rail. Oakland Airport is already the biggest airport for air freight between UPS and FedEx. We export more than even SFO, which is the passenger airport, but we're really the goods movement airport. And so they could probably use infrastructures that continues to grow to make the air operations for air freight more operational. What I'm concerned about is because my estuary and port areas are booming, that the integration of good freight management as well as good people movement. So, like, I was looking at the map and, okay, so this means that we should put an electric line maybe all along the Embarcadero because we've got the Army base, we've got Jack London, we're going to have Brooklyn Basin, and then we're going to have Coliseum City. And there's you're going to be integrating a lot of people living on the water along with maintaining the industrial base. I mean, the council and I, as mayor, have been trying to maintain a diverse economy, so we're trying to maintain as much of our industrial base, too. And I think I'd like this plan to look at how we're going to integrate that, because increasingly Oakland will be a place on the waterfront, and where these where the goods movement is will also be a residential area. And so how can we do that in a way that we don't kill each other, and that we can play the regional role that we do? And I have to say that when I make trade trips to China, I'm spending a lot of time helping sell products for people in the Central Valley. So I've become buddies with mayors in the Central Valley and in wine country, et cetera. And so I'd like to see intermodal regional projects that are based in Oakland, and then just on a very parochial level, because all of the trucks do come down 880, come down not so much on 580, but on our freeways and our streets. I particularly like to see increased Caltrans maintenance on that corridor, because our roads, I'm told, you spend as much money, but they look like hell. And it's because of the truck traffic, right? And that's sort of not fair for the Oakland residents, right? Because it's not, we're the hub of transportation, we get that, but you know, the quality of the road on particularly 880 deteriorates much faster than almost anywhere in the Bay Area. So I'm interested in ways that the arterials into 880 and around the port, that we get compensated for the damage of the trucks, as well as just 880 getting more funding so that we can maintain the part of it that goes near and around these industrial areas, because we are the hub. Everybody goes through Oakland, but and on top of that, we are the industrial hub for transportation with these really large trucks. Thank you.
Yeah, we will be looking at many of those issues, and a lot of them have come up in some of our initial stakeholder meetings, particularly with local jurisdictions whose local streets are feeling the impact both in terms of maintenance and congestion.
Okay. So I see no other comments. I have one speaker card, Rich Hedges. Rich, you want to? Rich is representing himself today. So do a good job, Rich.
Yeah, I don't want to embarrass anyone I know.
All right.
This is a question I've asked before, and I think it's really time to try to figure out the answer. Things that happen in world events, sometimes we think are remote. But just to read one line from an article about 2 years ago, China is investing heavily in a deep water port in Mexico. That's at Punta Colinay in the Baja Peninsula. They've spent, China's spending, and Walmart too, about $13 billion on this port. Kansas City Southern will pull the freight through Mexico to Kansas City. They've already hired 7,000 warehousemen in Kansas City. Instead of using the second largest rail yard in the country, they've torn up tremendous amounts of farmland to build a multimodal train train and truck pad, and they're building warehouses several football fields big. If I can move my cheap iPhone down, Red China is investing heavily, and they say that China wins the NAFTA superhighway battle. They're saying that this is going to be major freight to the Midwest. And I guess my question out of all this information is, we really need to know, as far as the international goods that travel through the Port of Oakland, I know this is going to have a large impact on LA's port, what that's going to mean. I know what it means for investors that invested in Kansas City Southern early on. There's really going to be a big reward for investors. But what is it going to be for cities and counties in California that have depended on the employment and who have spent money to try to build the infrastructure for these trucks that may no longer be running? So we may have, you know, we're going to still have the heavy traffic from local freight that's distributed outwardly and then brought back into the area. But we need to take a look at how that's going to impact what we're doing forward with the with the local streets and roads. Thank you. Hopefully I've embarrassed no one today.
No, you did a good job. Good question, too. Okay, if there's no other comments, then this meeting is adjourned. Thank you for the discussion.